1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 1. Paul, called as an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God, and Sosthenes, our brother, to the church of God which is at Corinth. From this passage, we can glean who it was that wrote the book. Easy enough. Now, where is the text that I could turn to in Matthew that will tell me that Matthew wrote the Gospel of Matthew? Doesn't exist. And that's true of all four gospel authors, as well as the author of the book of Acts. So this then begs the question, how do I know who wrote these books? For some of us, we may have never even bothered to ask that question before. You might be thinking, if somebody were to ask you, well, dummy, can't you read? Matthew says the gospel according to Matthew, and on and on and on. Well, I want to tell you that this is a question that it's good to know how to be able to answer. I was in a college class about 10 years ago or so, and one of my professors was going on and on about some of the great hoaxes that have been perpetrated on people. And he said, you know, it's kind of like, who wrote the Gospels? And I said, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And you can tell by his face that that was the wrong answer. Because reasonable people know that those men did not write these books. They were compiled hundreds of years later by a single editor that put them together, and then these names were slapped on them to give them some legitimacy. So how do we answer this question? It's a good one to be able to know. We might say, well, I don't have to worry about it because I believe that these books are inspired, and I know that at bottom the Holy Spirit wrote these books. Well, look back in Luke chapter 1. I, of course, believe in inspiration as well, but all through this course, I have not been arguing for their credibility from inspiration. And there's many people, like that college professor, that you could not, if he was even willing to hear you out, you couldn't reason with him from that. If you wanted to try to engage him in a serious discussion of how you know you can trust these books. In Luke chapter 1 and verse 2, Luke tells Theophilus, I've done my homework. And I'm writing so that you will know the exact truth about the things you've been taught. Well, how can I have credibility in what Luke wrote? Who did he say he spoke to in verse 2? Eyewitnesses. I wasn't there, but I talked to the people that were. And it's interesting that even though we would all agree that these texts were guided by the Holy Spirit still wanted Luke to tell Theophilus, I talked to people that were there. This is a big component of their credibility. And I need to know that Luke was the man that wrote it so that I can know that it was written by a doctor in the first century that actually was there and talked to people who saw these events. So then let's discuss how we can know who wrote these books. We won't look at every quote that I have on the first few pages of the lesson. We want to look at just a few of them to make the point. First of all, you need to understand this. We talked about the early Christian writings when we discussed the manuscript evidence and how we can know that the copies that we have, they accurately represent the documents that were first written by these men. And we pointed out that they quote almost 100% of the New Testament. So even if you lost every single manuscript of the New Testament, you can still reconstruct it from their quotations alone. Well, it's these people that we're looking at tonight at first. People like Papias, Irenaeus, Origen, Tertullian, on and on and on. It's these people that we want to appeal to at first. I want you to look at the first quotation we have about Matthew. And this is enough to demonstrate that the early Christian writings all testify that the books that bear these men's names were indeed written by these men. Every one of them said, Matthew wrote Matthew, Mark wrote Mark, Luke wrote Luke, and John wrote John. The first one is Papias. You'll notice his birth year, roughly 80 AD. That's good for us. He's showing up within the lifetime, maybe, of some of the apostles, if John is still alive at this point. Papias is being born. So he's showing up at a day and time when people would know who wrote these books. He said that Matthew wrote his book, I'm paraphrasing him there, in the Hebrew tongue. Irenaeus, born in 140 AD, the second one, He said, Matthew also issued a written gospel among the Hebrews. When you read Matthew's gospel, and this is good for us to know too, because it allows us to test what these men say about who wrote the books. When you read Matthew's gospel, can there be any doubt who his intended audience was?
No.
From the very first page, how does it begin?
Genealogies.
Who cares about genealogies?
Jews.
They wouldn't have cared how many miracles Jesus worked. They wouldn't have cared if he came back from the dead. If he wasn't the son of Abraham and the son of David, he was not the Messiah, period. And when you read Matthew's gospel, you can see there's no doubt even for yourself he wrote it to the Hebrews. That's exactly what Irenaeus says. And Origen as well confirms that Matthew wrote the fourth gospel. All right. We want to look as well at the second quotation from Irenaeus. Matthew also issued a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect. Irenaeus claims he knew Polycarp, who was born around 69 AD in his early youth, and that Polycarp always taught the things he had learned from the apostles. Now that's interesting, because now we have indicators that some of these men may have even, or did, sit at the feet of some of the apostles. I believe Polycarp was said to have had a close relationship with John. So he's going to be hearing straight from the horse's mouth, as it were, who wrote these four documents. The second one, Mark. There's a curious quotation here at the bottom of page 19, again from Papias. And we're going to examine a text later on in Mark's gospel that seems to back this point up. The elder, and that may be a reference to the Apostle John, he said this also. Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately everything that he remembered without, however, recording in order what was either said or done by Christ. So then Mark made no mistake, while he thus wrote down some things as he remembered them. For he made it his own care not to omit anything that he heard or to set down any false statements therein. A couple of things about that. Mark's gospel is the most action-packed of the four. A lot of moving around, a lot of miracles being performed, not a whole lot of Jesus' sermons. It also seems to be the most disjointed in terms of the sequence of events. Mark is not striving to tell you when everything happened exactly. He's just wanting to tell you what he knows happened. And his book very much reads that way. The other thing is his source. Papias says that Mark would have gotten most of his information from Peter. And there's a text particularly in chapter 14. In fact, let's just go over there and read that now. Mark 14, that I think would support what you see in the writings of the early church fathers, as they're called. In Mark chapter 14, you have the arrest and betrayal of Jesus. And in verse 46, they lay hands on him, they seize him. One of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Now, who is that?
Peter.
Now, it's interesting that Peter does not, or Mark, as he's relaying the story, does not say that it is Peter. And some people wonder perhaps that's Peter's latent humility coming through over his shame of how he reacted at these events, and now he's a changed man, and that may well be the case. But you have this moment, and then Jesus stops all of it. And in verse 50, after the resistance is halted by Jesus, they all left him and fled. Then you get to verses 51 and 52. And if you've ever read a part in your Bible where you think, what am I supposed to do with that? This may have been one of those sections, right? In verse 51, a young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body, and they seized him. But he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. And? What do I do with that? You read something like that and you think, tell me more about when Jesus was 12 years old. Tell me more about his ministry. Tell me more of his sermons. Why do I need to know that? Well, leave aside inspiration for a second. The only way that you would have known that this happened is if you had been there. Was Mark there?
If that was
him.
Sir? If that was him.
That could have been him. That's not where I'm going with this, but perhaps it was him. If it's not him, how does he even know what's going on here? He would have had to have spoken to somebody who was there. Now, who could he have spoken to? Well, this is going on after they have already arrested Jesus and began to transport him to the high priest. In verse 53, you pick back up. They're leading Jesus away to the high priest. And all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. Now, verse 54. Peter had followed him at a distance. So who was in the best position to see this event happen? Peter. Peter would have been there. He would have known. Mark would have got it from Peter. Now, there's another reference in the book of 1 Peter, chapter 5, that shows that there was a connection between the two. 1 Peter, chapter 5, and verse 13. First Peter 5, as he's closing out his letter, he says, "She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings, and so does my son, Mark." And just because you have the word son there, doesn't mean that there's a blood connection. In fact, I think Steve preached on some of that not too long ago, at least looking at the many uses of the word father. And Paul refers to Timothy as well in like fashion. But what it can simply indicate is that there is a close fellowship with one another. Yeah, particularly by means of the gospel, not necessarily through blood ties. So all of this would seem to support what the early Christian writers tell us about how Mark came by his information. Look on page 20. Let's talk about the good doctor. Yes?
Quick question. Peter being in the courtyard, how does Mark, without the Holy Spirit, taking that away, how does Mark know what went on with the high priest? If Peter is out in the courtyard, would that not be John?
Yes. John evidently had access to and a familiarity with the high priest. So Linda's question is, if you leave aside inspiration, how then does somebody like Mark know about what's going on inside with the immediate trial, so-called, with Jesus? John is the way into that. John's got the inside information there. So that's a good thing to point out. All right, page 20 with Luke. Again, we are told by... Now, first of all, the Moratorian fragment. What is the Moratorian fragment? It's a fragment. It's actually one of the tens of thousands of manuscripts that we have. The thing about these manuscripts is many of them are incomplete. And we saw that even with the oldest one that we talked about, dating back to 130. And sometimes in ancient texts that we find like this, you get some additional inside information. The same is true of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You find out about a different sect of the Jews that the New Testament does not talk about. And in the case of this fragment, you read that the first document definitely to ascribe the gospel to Luke is the Moratorian fragment, or at least that's the commentary by somebody that had studied it. So this one, going all the way back to 170 AD is when it would have been written, says that Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke. Irenaeus, born in 140, says that Luke wrote it. He also says he was the companion of Paul. That agrees, of course, with what we read in the book of Acts. And then you find this again with Clement of Alexandria. Now John, at the bottom of page 20, from Theophilus of Antioch, obviously not the same Theophilus that Luke and Acts are written to. This man is not born until 115 AD. He says that John says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God." That's how John's gospel begins. So from the middle of the second century, people are already saying that John wrote the most striking and unique of the four Gospels. You have the same accreditation listed in the Moratorian fragment once again on page 21. Again and again, Irenaeus and Clement of Alexandria. Now, if you look in John's Gospel and chapter 19, John does identify himself to the reader, just not by proper name. He always uses the phrase, the disciple whom Jesus loved. If you look back up at, for example, verse 25 and following, Jesus charges the care of his mother to him. Verse 27, he said to the disciple, verse 26, Jesus then saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby. Verse 27, he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. If you drop down further, a text that we've read before, the soldiers confirm that Jesus has died. They pierce his spear, his side with a spear. Verse 35, "He who has seen has testified. His testimony is true. He knows that he is telling the truth so that you also may believe." So the author says, "I was an eyewitness and I was there." Look back over in chapter 21. There's this little back and forth between Jesus and Peter. And Jesus exhorts Peter, "Tend my sheep, follow me." Then you get to verse 20. Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. Peter wants to know, what about this guy? You keep telling me to do things, what about him? And Jesus basically says, don't worry about him. You worry about what I'm telling you. You drop down to verse 24. John says, "This is the disciple who is testifying to these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true." In other words, I'm the one writing the book. So we have external evidence that says that John was the one that wrote the book. But then also, I'm not going to get into this tonight, but you can go through process of elimination. And some guys in their commentaries, they go through this very thing. How do you know it's John? And they'll take you through the thought process and how you can narrow it down to him just from the data that we have within the books themselves. So this is the first thing. All these quotations that attribute these books to these men. Look over in Mark 16 for a second. Mark chapter 16. The second thing is this. Every single manuscript that has a title on it says that Matthew wrote Matthew, Mark wrote Mark, etc. Now, not every manuscript has a title. A lot of them do and a lot of them don't. In Mark chapter 16 and verse 9, this is where we want to look. Mark 16 and verse 9. Does your Bible by any chance have a footnote on this verse that mentions something about the manuscripts? Probably everybody's, just about, if you have a study Bible at least. My Bible says that later, and MSS is just the abbreviation for manuscripts, later manuscripts add verses 9 through 20. What that tells you is that some of the earlier manuscripts lack the second half of the chapter. Now, there's a logical explanation for that. When I'm done reading my Bible, I just close it. But in the first century, when you're done reading Mark, you roll it up like a newspaper. And as you're carrying that newspaper around, it's the outside portion that's going to take the most beating. And it's going to be weathered and worn out the quickest. And a lot of times, that outside portion is where they would slap a tag that said, who wrote the document? And that was the first part of it, usually, to disintegrate and break off. So for many of the manuscripts, yes, it's true, no names are on there, but that's because often the authorship was attributed on the outside. That would also explain why some of the earliest texts don't have this section of Mark. It just came off. It's highly unlikely that Mark would write his book and then just stop with verse 8, especially when the other three don't stop in such fashion. Another thing about the titles that we have, sometimes it is said that there are variances in the titles, and that should not surprise any of us. We just talked about the fact that there are variances in our manuscripts. Quite a few, right? Three times the number of words. We have three times as many variances as we do the number of words in our New Testament. But what's the overwhelming majority of those variances made up of?
Spelling errors.
There are some variances in the titles of these books, but they usually go something like this. At least this is how it was told to me. Some of them say the Gospel according to John, and some of them say according to John. That's how it works out. You will not find one that says the Gospel according to John and the Gospel according to Fred. It doesn't work that way. But if you don't tell somebody that and just say, there's a lot of variances in the titles and the authors of the books that we have, it sounds like almost there's 10, 15, 20, 35 different people claiming they all wrote the Gospel of John. It's not true. And that's one of those intentionally misleading, twisting that people do with some key facts. All right, now let's talk about what we know about these men. Look at Matthew 9. Yes, Rocky.
So some manuscripts contain titles. So I was wondering if you could comment, well, if for those manuscripts that do contain titles, is that not proof that those men were probably authors?
Yes, I would say so. If it has the name of the author on it, you take it at its word. So of the manuscripts that say Matthew wrote Matthew, there's no reason to think otherwise. And the same would be true of every one of them. Yeah. Other questions? All right, Matthew chapter 9. So we have all these quotations from people in the immediate centuries after the close of the first century. And we have manuscript evidence itself that says these men wrote these books. Now let's talk about what we know about them. I want to know if these guys are reliable. Can I trust what they say? Were they level-headed? Clear thinkers? Or were they guys that just believed any old story that came along? At Matthew chapter 9 and verse 9, we read something very important about Matthew, the author of the book and one of the 12. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said to him, "Follow me," and he got up and followed him. This guy is a tax collector. And because of that, he is maybe the most unlikely man to become part of the original 12. None of us like to pay taxes. None of us like dealing with tax collectors. They all seem to have the charisma of a damp rag. But none of us feel like, probably, the tax collector is working for the man. The man from overseas. We might feel more the way the Jews felt if perhaps we were still under British rule. And we're not. Most of us just don't feel like when we are paying our taxes that we're paying it to support the hostile takeover of our nation by some enemy people. But that's how Jews felt. It wasn't just that they had to pay money. They had to pay money to finance their enemies. That really didn't care about them, didn't care about their way of life, their God that they worshipped, or anything like that. If you look in verse 10, you can see the disdain that the Jews had for tax collectors. And it's interesting, Matthew doesn't even shy away from talking about it. It happened that as Jesus was reclining at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and sinners?" Now, first of all, let's talk about what they mean by sinners. I thought everybody was a sinner. True? Yeah. But some people are aware of their sins, and they try to live a penitent life. And other people just don't care. And when they talk about sinners in the gospel in this text, they're talking about people that don't care to make any change in their life. They don't care about what the will of God is. They have lumped tax collectors in with those people. And when I read this text, I think of what John said in John 4 when Jesus talks to the woman at the well, the Samaritan lady, and she's shocked. And John tells his readers, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Well, they also, as much as they could help it, they had no dealings with tax collectors as well. Look at Matthew 18.
as you read all this and you think about it, I always wonder, how does a guy like Matthew get along with Simon the Zealot? If Simon the Zealot is the guy that wants to just throw Rome off, let's have the war now, I'll kill as many of them as I can, I'm going down fighting, and Matthew's the guy working for the man, how do those two get along with each other? But it's amazing that common faith and common walk in Jesus can help people even overcome their political differences and work together in spite of those. Look at Matthew 18 and verse 17. Jesus talks about the process of disfellowship. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. If he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile. Is a Jew going to call up a Gentile and say, let's go get a pizza?
No.
I don't have anything to do with a Gentile. And tax collector. They're not thought of very highly at all by their people. Yet Matthew decides, this is what I'm going to do. So is he the kind of guy to just roll over for what most people think? Doesn't seem like it. Is he the kind of guy to worry about, what are they going to say about me at the dinner party? I don't think so. Plus, being a tax collector, I'm sure that he knew something about counterfeit. Probably by experience from his job, he might have even been a little bit cynical about people. I know when people are out, I know that, rather, people are always out to try to fool their fellow man. And yet, here is a man that becomes not just a disciple of Jesus, but one that's willing to suffer to the death. And it says something about Jesus that he invites a man like this into his confidence. I want maybe the most skeptical, cynical man that he could have selected, and I want him to walk with me for 3 years. As well, we know from him being one of the 12, he would have been an eyewitness of most of what he saw. So this is a primary source document here. Yes? Sure. Well, there's no doubt that Jesus would have known that he was picking a good man and not somebody that would have been worthy of the disdain, perhaps, that Jews held for most other tax collectors. All right, the second guy, Mark. We're not going to read any of the verses that we have here for him. I've already looked at the text in Mark 14. I do want to say that I said on the lesson that he was Barnabas' nephew. Only the King James Version says that. All the other translations say that he was a cousin. And it may be there's some dispute over how to translate that word that shows up in the manuscripts. Maybe he wasn't a nephew, but he was related to him, at least somehow. Really irrelevant, but just in case you're reading a different version like the New King James or New American Standard and you're wondering why it doesn't say nephew, that's the reason. Look on page 22. Let's turn to Luke chapter 5. So Luke, we know Luke is a physician from what Paul wrote in Colossians 4. We're going to skip that reference for now. Luke was with Paul in Philippi. He was with him when they were shipwrecked on the island of Malta. We know from the book of Acts that he's not just a spectator in some parts. He's right there in the middle of the action along with the man whose adventures he's chronicling. One of the things that is interesting to me is you read Luke's gospel and you compare it to Matthew and Mark, the three that we call the synoptics because they're so similar in their outlook on Jesus. Luke has a physician's attention to detail. He really does seem to be a little bit more interested in medical details than the other guys are when they talk about these things. So for example, in Luke 5 and verse 12, while he was in one of the cities, behold, there was a man full of or covered with leprosy. Your version might say. He saw Jesus, fell on his face, and implored him, saying, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. What's the big deal about that? Matthew and Mark tell the same story, but all they say is, he was a leper. Well, if I have leprosy and it's just in my hand, I'm a leper. But I'm not as bad off as this man. Luke wants to know, how bad was he? It's not confined to a hand or a foot. He's covered with it. This is destroying him, head to toe, perhaps. That's the man that wants Jesus to heal him. Turn over to chapter 6. Here's another leper. Chapter 6 and verse 6. On another Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. Matthew and Mark tell the same story. Neither one of them really care which hand it was. But a doctor does. Give me all the details you can. Right, Sally? Yeah, she's over there laughing. Yeah, doctors want to know that kind of stuff. Luke wants to know it too. Look at chapter 8. Chapter 8, in verse 55. Now, this is the resurrection of Jairus' daughter. When Jesus comes into the room, in verse 54, he took her by the hand and called, saying, "Child, arise." Now, when you read about it in Matthew, Mark, they say that she got up. They leave it at that. Well, Luke wants a little more detail. How did she get back up? Verse 55, her spirit returned. That is the definition of resurrection. When the spirit returns to the body, that's what gives life to the body, as James says in his analogy in James 2. Luke wants to know exactly what makes this work. And it's not just that the power of God is vested in Jesus, it's what is the power of God able to do. He's able to call the departed spirit back to the child's body and bring her forth once more. So, interesting man that we have here. You think a doctor knows where babies come from? Not from the stork, right? He's the kind of guy that knows that virgins usually don't have children. You think a doctor would know that when people die, they tend to stay dead? And yet, even though he is trained to look for a naturalistic explanation, he is an ardent believer in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, even the virgin birth of Christ, and he records all of it in meticulous detail. And as we saw earlier, like Mark, he's not there, but he's talking to people that were. And his testimony harmonizes with the testimony of two men that were there, Matthew and John. John, we've already discussed, Jesus' best friend. What other way can you put it? This is the guy that's going to take care of his mother. You don't give her to some stranger. Yes, sir?
He also used the word immediately.
In Luke's gospel?
Yes.
Yes.
She got immediately
and
she ate food.
Yes, he does. So we have with John, somebody that's close to Jesus, with Peter and James, he gets to witness a few key events that other guys don't, like the resurrection of Jairus' daughter in Luke. And we also know, as we saw in John 19, that he's an eyewitness. So these are the first four. Let's look at Paul. We're running out of time, so let's talk about him for a little bit. If you look, for example, in Galatians 1, Paul admits, and Luke even records himself, that this is perhaps the most unlikely of converts to Christianity that ever lived. Paul is not just a Jew, he's a Jew to the core. And in Galatians 1:13, he talks about who he was as Saul of Tarsus when it came to destroying Christianity. Paul was not a weekend warrior. He was dedicated to it 1,000%. He said, "I used to persecute the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it. I didn't just care if they were run out of town. I wanted them gone forever." The single greatest enemy of Christianity in the first century. He says in 1 Corinthians 15, "Jesus appeared to me." Luke says three times in Acts that Jesus appeared to Paul. Once again, this just seems weird. You don't read about this guy in any of the four Gospels. He just shows up in Acts. And you wonder, well, why didn't Jesus appear to Pilate or Caiaphas or Herod? Like a friend of mine said, he had bigger fish to fry. Paul's devotion to the law of Moses tells you that he would not have made this decision lightly. He would have known that if he was believing in a false Messiah, he was going to hell. So he had to be convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus was who he said he was. And for that reason, we can conclude that he would not have been dishonest. He knew exactly what was awaiting him when he gave up Moses and went to Jesus. He was the one who was putting people to death. He knew what to expect. He wasn't a guy that was easily swayed. Paul is the most independent man in the New Testament, second only to Jesus. And he wasn't delusional. You can read his writings and tell. He has a keenly honed mind, as even he recalls. It was shaped at the feet of Gamaliel. All right, look on page 23. By the way, if you check the class website, I have a PDF document that I've asked Steve to attach with tonight's lesson, written by Lord Littleton, an Englishman that lived in the 1700s. And we've talked about him before briefly. He was swayed from skeptic to believer just by studying the conversion of Paul. And I've found that online. I'm going to make that available to you if you want to read it. All right, so page 23. Let's put these guys to a few more tests. We know who wrote the books, but just because these men wrote the books, that in and of itself doesn't prove anything. We can put them to some further tests to find out if they are reliable. First of all, their honesty. How could I know that these men at least believed they were sincere? They were given truth serum. James was beheaded in Acts 12. Paul was beaten and tortured. In Acts 8, when you read about Saul whipping up the first persecution in Jerusalem, everybody flees but the apostles. Matthew and John are there. They see firsthand what this guy is capable of. It won't change. None of this proves in and of itself that they are right. You can't just say because a religious person is willing to die for their faith that they're right. You could say that about Muslims. That doesn't prove anything. What it does prove is they thought they were right. It proves that they were sincere. Secondly, their ability. They're men of sound mind and body. We've noted that based on how archaeology and history confirm what they say. You can tell by the detail in Luke's gospel. He is a keen historian on the lookout for the most minute of details. Yes, they are credible documentarians of eyewitness accounts of the resurrection of Jesus. They're credible eyewitnesses as well. And they're consistent. In our next lesson, the material for which is outside, if you want a print copy, we're going to talk about on Sunday whether or not they contradict each other. The people say, and they have said for thousands of years, yes, they contradict each other. Let's talk about some of the really hard ones. And I think you'll see, nobody can sustain the charge of contradiction. And not only that, but if you're still in Galatians 1, look in verse 6, rather verses 8 and 9, as these books were being written, there was a fail-safe test already in place to determine whether or not they were accurately transmitting the kernel of the gospel. Paul said in verse 8, even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we have preached to you, he is to be accursed. As we have said before, so I say again now. Let me drive it home even further. If any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received, he is to be accursed. As people were reading Matthew's gospel, they were supposed to be thinking, is this what I heard Jesus say on the mount? Is this what Matthew and John preached to me? So there was already a system in place to determine whether or not these men were accurately reporting to people that would have known what Jesus said, even within the first century. All right, so some brief takeaways here then. Page 23. We can be certain that the four Gospels and Acts and 1 Corinthians, they were written by eyewitnesses, or they were founded on eyewitness testimony, which is the highest level of credibility. These are primary source documents. We can be certain that the authors were not gullible, dishonest, or inconsistent, and that they were reliable historians, no more biased than the rest of us. And I'm so sick of people pretending like we should all be dispassionate when it comes to talking about things that matter to us. It is aggravating when Fox News says fair and balanced. They are the propaganda wing for the GOP. They might as well own it. CNN is not a dispassionate reporter of news. They are the propaganda arm of the Democratic Party. Own it.
Tell me what you are after and what you're promoting. I can decide for myself whether or not I believe in it. And if Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John say, I believe in it, tell me that. And I should tell other people what I believe too. They can evaluate for themselves whether or not I'm blinded by my beliefs. The question is whether or not I have a good reason to believe what I believe in. And these men are no more biased than anybody else. And they're also not credulous, uninformed people. And they're not unrealistically dispassionate. So, with 10 or 15 seconds left, hold your finger, Michael. Let's talk about the Gnostic Gospels at the very bottom. A lot has been made about this in recent years. The Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, Judas, etc. Why not these? Why aren't they in our Bible? Why don't we talk about them? Lots of reasons not to think they're credible. They make all kinds of awful mistakes that Luke and others would not make. They talk about high priests that would spend the night in a graveyard. They wouldn't do that. They quote from a harmony of the Gospels that was written about 170 AD. That tells you they're even later than that. They're not talking to eyewitnesses like Luke is. They're not eyewitnesses themselves like John and Matthew. And they say things that blatantly contradict what we know is historically reliable, which is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I know of absolutely no good reason to even think that they are worthy of our time and study as reliable records of Jesus and who he was. If you want to know more about that, I recommend a book at the end of page 24. And that goes into a pretty good refutation of those books and why they're not worth your time. All right, thank you.